The following podcast is a presentation of Sunridge Community Church.
I don't know how many of you can remember way back when you had those first dates with people. Remember those times, you know? I find that when I go to speak somewhere the first time, it's kind of a first date thing, I find. You know, you feel like, if I say this, will they take it this way? If I say that, you know, it's kind of a... Remember when I first... dated my wife, I picked her up, offered her a ride home from work, and I drove her home. I shouldn't even say this because it's so bad, but I had one of those vans back then with the murals on the side, you know, and the fur on the inside with the mirror in the roof. Oh, embarrassed. I didn't know Jesus back then. But I drove her home, and I said, could I have your phone number? And she wrote it down so small, I thought, I don't think she really likes me. So we can read all kinds of things into that. A few months ago, I just turned the television on. I can't remember what I was doing. Just kind of had a couple hours of free time. You know, sometimes if you just sit down, you're kind of tired. And this film came on, and I just was engrossed. And it was a film that had me cheering, a film that at times had tears in my eyes. And it really impacted me. And then I went and did a little bit of research. Just happened to stumble across some things about that film. And I want to just begin this morning by just sort of drawing into that. I don't know if you ever see, but Time Magazine and Newsweek Magazine, they always have these sort of things at the end of the year, the most popular person of the year or the biggest news story of the year. But back years ago, in 1938, they wouldn't have had, I don't think they had Newsweek Magazine, those kind of things back then, or even television news like we have today, but newspapers were the big thing that communicated. And in 1938, in the United States, there was one story that was the biggest story that people followed throughout the year than any other story. And the number three person that year that was the big story was Adolf Hitler, which we can, you know, probably imagine. Then the second most popular story of that year covered was President Roosevelt. Is that how you say his name? But the most talked about and followed story of 1938 was not a story about a person, but about an animal. And I don't even know, I mean, some of you may be better history buffs than I am, if there's ever been an animal that has captured and been the big story for a year since then. But back then, it was a story of a racehorse called Seabiscuit. And some of you may have seen that movie. The question is, as I pondered that, I thought, what is it about that story that captured a nation? That they were engrossed to follow the story of this racehorse. What was going on there? Well, in some ways, this racehorse captured what the nation was going through. See, back in 1938, it was the Great Depression. Over a quarter of the people in the United States were out of work. They said it was so hard at times that people had to eat weeds in certain places. It was just a very, very, the nation felt very beat up. And along comes this horse that has great breeding, but has turned out not to look like a racehorse. It was too short, and entered the first 17 races and lost. And they tried to straighten this horse out, thought it could do better, but it was really a beat-up little racehorse that all of a sudden got involved with these three other men that also had beat-up stories. And it started to rise up and win. And the three men were also very beat up. The sort of man that bought the racehorse, and he bought it for a song, was a man who was a millionaire that had lost everything, and even had lost his son. And then started to rebound, kind of got some money together again, started to dip into racehorsing, and bought this little horse. But around that little horse, he also had a jockey that was almost too big to be a jockey. That young man, his parents had been so poor during the Depression, they had basically just left him at a big horse stable to be like a stable boy. So he had sort of been abandoned, had a very beat-up story, and from what I understand, at least in the movie, a drinking problem. And then there was this trainer who also was just loved horses and a great trainer, but was a bit more of a cowboy than a sophisticated horse trainer and didn't want to ever put down a horse because it sort of couldn't be raced anymore, and he would say it would be a good cart horse and those kind of things, and kind of had ended up sort of off on the sides and also a broken-up story. So we have these three people and this racehorse, and they're all kind of broken and beaten up. And the country connected with that story and wanted to follow it. It gave them hope. It gave them inspiration to move forward, that somehow they were going to get out of this beat-up state they were in. This morning, we're going to look at Psalm 23. I'm not sure if you are familiar with the Bible or not. I don't know how far along you are in your journey, or you've just stumbled in here this morning. But it's probably one of the most popular passages in all of Scripture, Psalm 23. Why? Why does that psalm connect with us? I think there's a lot of reasons that that psalm connects with, just like the Seabiscuit story connected with the people in 1938. And let's just turn there. We're going to read that psalm. And I think that psalm gives us two images of God that we really need to grasp and remind ourselves of. But I want to just give you a little background before I read the psalm. It's a psalm by David. You know, David is, after Jesus in the Scriptures, there's more written about David than anybody else in all of Scriptures. Is that okay? And then we know just a few things about David. David is a man after God's own heart. We know he's the youngest son of this man called Jesse. We know that when the prophet is told to go anoint one of Jesse's sons to be king, he's going to be the future king, that the prophet goes and goes through all the Jesse's sons, and none of them, the prophet has a sense that is the anointed one. And they say, "Do you have any more sons?" And they say, "Well, you know, I have this youngest son, the shepherd boy, David, out in the field." And they go and get David, and the prophet anoints him, and we know that he is going to be the future king. We know that David fights Goliath. We know that this big dude named Goliath, everybody was afraid of him. Nobody would fight him. And David goes forward with his slingshot, the whole David and Goliath story. We know that David, after being chased around by King Saul, even though all David wanted to do was sort of serve the king and be a warrior under the king, that the King Saul was very jealous of David and chased him around for over 10 years, probably hiding out in the caves. And you've heard of David's mighty men were kind of these riff-raff gang of outlaw bikers that David had around him as he got chased around by the king. And then David becomes king, and we know that the next probably big story in his life is that he falls into sin with a lady named Bathsheba. He ends up committing adultery with her. But David does, years go on, David raises a family and has a number of children, and one son he has is a guy called Absalom, and that son decides that he wants to become king. He's not going to wait around for his dad to sort of keel over, and he basically revolts against his dad, gathers support and an army, and basically chases David out of Jerusalem with David and some of his key people that are around him have to leave. And that's where they think at that time is when this psalm was written. That's what the scholars say. I'm not a scholar, but the scholars I read and researched, they figure this is the time when David writes these words. So we need to understand, I think, to read them, is that this is a time when David is being basically chased by his own son, who basically wants his head, that David writes these words. It's amazing. So let's just read them out. "The Lord is my shepherd, I lack nothing. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside quiet waters. He refreshes my soul. He guides me along the right paths for his name's sake. Even though I walk through the darkest valley, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil. My cup overflows. Surely goodness and love will follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever." We have to understand that to live life is to live a journey. We're all on a journey. Our planet is turning. We're all moving. We're on this journey. That is life. A journey that has many ups and downs, twists and turns. Just like the Seabiscuit story, at times we could be celebrating a win. Other times we seem very beaten down and broken. But we're on this journey. In some ways, I'd say we don't have a choice not to live the journey. History is being written. God's story is being written, and we've landed in it. Whether we connect with God and walk with God and follow his ways is our choice. But none of us can live outside of God's story. All of us have landed. If you're born, created by God, we have all landed in the story. We're in it. And there's a journey that we're all a part of. And God calls us to live a journey. The church must always understand that it's on a journey. It is really neat to be here. Just as I said, Mike and to Teresa, there's something good going on here. I had a sense as you guys, as we were just singing, that this is good. Sunridge is on a journey. One of the earliest symbols that the church had was a boat. And they picked a boat because a boat is much more stable when it's moving than when it's sitting still. We always got to realize that we're on a journey. Someone has said when the church is not on a journey, it becomes a relic. And, you know, and I'll talk about this a bit later on, but I spent a year in Ireland. And it is so sad. You go to these old ruins of these churches, and there's graves all around, so the property, on the property, so the property can't be developed into anything else. But there's these big old stone walls. And sometimes at the front, where it would have been the altar or where the priest would have been, there's these trees that are this big now that have grown up right through and right out through the roof. Just these sort of relics of what used to be. One of the old church leaders says, the best Christian is one who has lived with one foot raised. We're all on a journey. But I think, you know, when we think about this journey, a journey does push against our control. Just, I think there's something in us that always wants to be settled and in control, and a journey pushes us against that. Many times I think we are tempted, I've been tempted, to abandon the journey God has for me. It messes up my routines, my norms. You have to travel, it can mess up your favorite food. When you travel and you're journeying, there's always delays, inconveniences. In other words, when we travel, and think about your travel plans this summer, a lot of your normal control and routine gets kind of thrown out. When you travel many times, all kinds of things happen that you can't control. Irritations, interruptions, hardship, discomforts, lost luggage, missed connections, canceled flights. It's interesting that the English word for travel comes from the French word suffer, which comes from the Latin word for this three-pronged instrument of torture. But it is true. We're on a journey, and there are twists and turns. Mike prayed, and it was announced that there's some real struggles going on amongst the people that are connected here. And that is why I believe that in this passage, we need to be reminded of two things, two images of God that we need, two sort of parts that we can say how we can describe God. The first thing, in verses 1 to 4, David describes God as what? Shepherd, as guide. That we do have a shepherd. We do have a guide. Have you ever felt at times like you just really feel like your life journey or direction is kind of lost and very confusing? I have. I mean, I'm going to talk a little bit about it at the end, but a couple years ago, I felt like I had walked into some kind of giant corn maze, and all I was doing is going around and around trying to find my way out, and I kept looking up to God thinking, you should be on that big ladder somewhere that points me in the right direction, because I feel like I just can't get out of this thing. But this psalm reminds us that we are on a journey, that God is our guide. I think there's a real myth we have about we feel that everything in life should be very organized, orderly, and settled. I've struggled with that even as a pastor. You know, I need to be a real spiritual manager. And I found that kind of frustrating at times because life is just, everything about life is very hard to manage. Someone has said that there's a danger. We have gone from the order of worship to the worship of order. You know, and I think sometimes all of a sudden life spins as something different we didn't expect, and our whole order is sort of thrown out. But if you think about it, we're called to live by faith. So there's really parts of our life that are always going to be beyond us, parts of the unknown that are always there. We're on this journey, and there's always going to be this part that we don't quite know where it's going. You know, I would love to say as a as a guy who's leading a gathering of people that were launching out into a new church, that I could nail you down the five-year plan. I wish I had that in all kinds of detail, but I don't. And part of me wants that. I feel like I should be able to manage it and have the order and have that all figured out, but I don't. As a pastor, I think I've come to realize at times that I have actually worked against what Jesus was doing. Jesus disciples us through tension on this journey. Remember the 12 guys are following Jesus, and they come out to this. There's a big field. They're all hanging out. There's 5,000 people. And Jesus says, I think you should feed these guys. Well, we only have a couple of pieces of fish and a few loaves of bread. Tension. At times when they get into a boat, there's a big storm. Tension. And I have felt many times that as a pastor, it's my job to calm the water. Make sure there's, get rid of the tension in people's lives. And a part of that is true. We do need to comfort and help each other. But part of times when God is at work in us, he does work through tension. And on this journey at times where we are struggling, it's how God is really showing us our absolute dependence on him. And he is the good guide. David makes that statement when there is probably wanted signs all around the nation of Israel with his picture on it, wanted dead or alive. And Jesus says, the Lord is guiding me. He's my shepherd. And he says, makes me lie down in what? By quiet waters, in green pastures, and I lack nothing. What a statement to make. I think if I was King David, I would be saying, man, I lack my palace and all the things I had back in Jerusalem. Now I've been chased out of there. I lack that I've lost control of the country. I lack that I've lost control of my family. But David says, no, no, no. I lack nothing. An amazing, amazing statement. Irwin McManus wrote a book called Soul Cravings. And in that book, he explains that there's three cravings deep in us that God has put in there. A craving for intimacy, a craving for meaning, and a craving for destiny. And David is saying, those are met. I have this walk with my guide. I have this intimacy. I know my life has meaning, and I know it has destiny. How many times do we really look for intimacy, meaning, and destiny in other places than God? I do at times. But David can make that statement, even though you'd say his life is very chaotic, that he lacks nothing. The other thing David says about this, about the good shepherd, the good guide, is he says, he leads me along right paths for his name's sake. In other words, because of who God is, because of his name, he will lead me the right way. Again, how could he say that when it felt like it was a wrong path, I'm sure, to have his own son chasing him. But David said it's the right path. You ever gone somewhere and felt like you're on the wrong path, the wrong road, only to find out later you're on the right one? I remember going to New York for the first time. Green, Kelowna guy, stepped out of the plane, and there's me and my friend, and there's this tall guy, big guy, and he says, you guys need a cab? I said, yeah. So we need to go to this place. I said, how much? He says, $20. I said, okay. So then he says, wait here. So we stand out in front of the airport. All of a sudden we see this beat up looking big Cadillac thing pulls up. And I'm thinking, it looked like a cab. Anyhow, we get in this thing. And he says, oh, I know a shortcut. Takes us down below these bridges, and there's all these sort of deserted houses and abandoned cars that are all missing wheels. I'm thinking, we're not on the right path. We're on the path to get robbed. This is not the right way at all to where we're going. But we were on the right path. And he did take us on a shortcut. And we got there in record time. But there's been times I know in my own life that I've felt like somehow God has, or I've ended up on a wrong path. Just hard to understand. Trying to follow Jesus, trying to live out my call, but it felt like somehow I'd missed it. Somehow I must have gotten off track on the wrong path. But I also want to mention, as we talk about a shepherd, I want us to think about David's picture of a shepherd. I think at times we see these pictures of a shepherd, and he looks like this really wimpy guy, that just frolics around in the green grass with very clean sheep that don't smell. And But in David's mind, he was a shepherd. And what does it say if we read about the, you know, about the David and Goliath story, when David is going to says to the king, "I'm going to go up and fight this guy called Goliath," and the king says, "No, man, you're too small, you're too young, you can't handle it." And David says, "Hey, I was a shepherd." I mean, that doesn't sound very tough, right? I was a shepherd. And then David goes, "When a lion and a bear came in and took one of the sheep, I went after it, clobbered it, and then when the bear and lion turned on me, I grabbed him by the hair and I killed him." Wow. That's pretty warrior-like, tough shepherd stuff, I think. I think if I was a shepherd, I'd think, "Oh, got a lot more sheep than that. He's hungry. Let him have one." Kind of God's food chain cycle. You know, I would have sort of somehow got out of it. But that's the picture we see. David knows this is what a shepherd is like, and God is you know, he's a protector. He's a warrior at times too. Looks after us. And Jesus says very clearly, you know, the good shepherd is the one that leaves the 99 to go and find the one that's lost. A good shepherd guides his sheep. And in the Middle East, there's not a lot of big grassy fields like you'd see in England or Ireland or down in Vancouver. It's a lot of dry, you know, not a lot of grassy areas. And they have to travel through up and down through probably dry areas with rocks and all kinds of things. But the shepherd guides and leads them through all that kind of stuff. He's a bit of a warrior. I think sometimes as a, you know, we talk about shepherds being a pastor, kind of that whole connection. You shepherd the flock, and we think the shepherd should just be this kind of a really, you know, wimpy guy that just takes care of all our needs, you know. But a good shepherd is one that will lead through all kinds of stuff and lead through, as I mentioned before, through the tension, all that kind of, to get to where we need to be and to help God shape us. It says also, too, that the shepherd will lead us in verse 4, I think it is, even through the darkest valley. I think some of the older traditions say death valley. That even though I walk in that place, which we mentioned earlier, a couple places that are very, very dark, I will fear no evil, for you're with me. Your rod and staff, they comfort me. It is said about the old preacher, John Wesley, the guy who founded the Methodist Church, that he was fearless. I mean, he could just go anywhere. He would go into any crowd. He would go to, just like his friend, George Whitfield. They would stand up amongst all these rough coal miners and speak. They would go anywhere. They were fearless. But also, you need to understand that John Wesley had a wife that was a little bit loopy. You know, she was difficult, put it that way. And if you read about his life, and there was times he said he got to speak at a church and his wife would stand up and say, "He's a liar," and had to kind of take her out, you know. I mean, can you imagine having that kind of support? So there's other times that it is said that when they went to pick him up to go somewhere, his wife would come to the door and she'd have a handful of his hair. So, I mean, it was a tense relationship. She was a little nutty. But it is said that these two guys one night decided that they were going to challenge his fearlessness. So they, after he spoke one evening in a church service, they hid in this dark valley with really overgrown with trees, and they hid in there. And Wesley came riding along on his horse. And of course, these guys were up there. Wesley went, "Who goes there?" And they said, "It's the devil." And he said, "Get out of my way. I'm married to your sister." Anyway. Yeah. You know, even though, you know, and it's interesting because it says, even though I walk through this dark valley, I will fear no evil. Do you know that the number one command in all of Scripture is to fear not, or peace be with you? More than any other thing in the Scriptures, God comes to us and tells us that. You know, I think when we do go through darkest valleys, fear just rises up in us. Fear rises up in us. It's just something, and God is constantly coming and saying, "Don't fear. Don't fear." David makes that comment. Even though he's being chased, there's people out wanting to kill him, he says, "I will not fear." So that's the first image that we need to remind ourselves, that God is our shepherd. He is guiding us. It may not seem at times like he's there. We can't figure out how this trail is really, where it's really going and what's happening, but I just want to remind you today that God is our shepherd. The second image is that the Lord as host. Verses 5 and 6. The Lord as host. I want you to think of a time. It says, "You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil. My cup overflows. It's a hard sometimes, I think for me, as I thought this week, to picture God as host. That somehow, if God wants to invite me into his table, he wants to host me, to serve me. Again, we see that with Jesus when he washes the disciples' feet. Says, you want to be great? Be a servant. But I still have a hard time getting my head around God as a host. The Message version says, you serve me a six-course dinner right in the midst of my enemies. You know, last week I did a wedding. We got invited to the reception. I had a four-course dinner. My wife and I were both, man, it's supposed to cost a fortune. It was really good. When I read that six-course dinner, I thought, wow, God is like that. That even though I happen to have all this crazy stuff going on around me, people that don't like me, people that have misunderstood me, I have, you know, some kind of enemy out there. Right in the middle of that, God says, I will host you and serve you a six-course dinner. I have a hard time really getting my head around that God is my host. It's amazing. But we see this picture again in the story of the prodigal son. Well, what, this one son takes off and he does all these things, and then we see the father who, what, in the story represents God the Father. And what does he do? He runs out and welcomes him back and says, what, fire up the barbecue, get some good clothes on him, get him cleaned up. We see this father who's this amazing host, and they have this big meal celebration. You and I have a picture of God that he wants to sit us down, serve us a great meal, get the wine, all the stuff that we really, really like, and host us. That's the picture David is giving us here. It's amazing. I got to admit, this week it was hard for me to get my head around. The other part of it is, surely goodness and love will follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. You know, I have spoke this psalm at funerals, you know, that we will get home one day, home. And it wasn't till this week as I was pondering, I thought, what does it mean to really finally be home? Home. A place where we are with God. And I thought there's this part that we are at home with God, but I also think to be finally home in the Lord's house or Lord's temple, the Lord's tavern, whatever term you want to put, is to also be at home with ourselves. And I ask you that, are you at home with yourself? As you journey more and more towards Jesus and with Jesus, you should become more and more at home with ourselves. Many times we're not. We're just not at home with ourselves. Oh, my, don't like my body, don't like my looks, I'm not smart enough, not spiritual enough. We're not, you know what I mean? We go through all this stuff that, yes, we need to be motivated to try and improve and have our character shaped to be more like Jesus. But are we at home with who we are? Are we at home with who we are? I think one day we will get to that place. We will truly be at home with God and with who we really are. Kind of like right back at the very beginning in the Garden of Eden. It says, that has that little line that you kind of wonder about, and they were both naked and they felt no shame. They were absolutely at home with themselves. I just want to tell a little bit as I close my story of how this really struck me. I have to go back a couple years, September to 2007. And I just want to give you a bit of background. In 2006, my wife and my children, we sold up everything and went to Ireland. That was going to be our future. That was our dream. We were going to go to Ireland and work there, church planting and being missionaries in the Republic of Ireland in Cork for the rest of our lives. It was a dream that had started in my mind about 15 years before that, when I ran into a crazy Irish guy in 1990 who said, "You should come to Ireland. We don't have very many Protestant churches over there. You should come over to Ireland." And of course, not much about the Irish. They always just yammer on and talk like that. But he invited us, and you know, over the years we had contact and different things. And I got into pastoring, and things went really well, but this thing about, you know, we had gone to Prairie Bible College because we really wanted to go to the mission field felt that's where God was taking us. And this Irish thing just kept hounding in my head. And finally, in 2005, I actually went over there to figure out, as a church, how could we help what was going on in Ireland. And when I got over there, I was basically offered this, would you come over and help this little, small, struggling, kind of trying to be a church plant, get moving? And I, when they said that, it just was like, wow. They said, we can only pay you this much, which was about a third of what we need. And they said, no, it's even wrong for us to ask that. We couldn't ask you to bring your family all the way over to Ireland for this amount. And I said, well, if I could raise some support, maybe that would work, but I'll go home and pray about it. So we did. We prayed about it and raised the support, just kind of announced that this is where we felt God was be taking us. And within like a month, we had all our money raised, which is usually when you go to as a missionary, raising support is the most difficult thing. It just fell into place. We're like, wow, this is where God's taken us. This is awesome. And it was this dream that was in me. You know, we said to everybody, we're going to die in Ireland. You know, we're going to go over there and serve the rest of our lives. Anyhow, to make a long story short, from almost the minute we stepped off the plane, everything went sideways. And we have a special needs daughter. We had checked into the system over there. We were told that that everything was comparable to Canada, and we realized once we got over there and got investigating and trying to get connected with their programs that nothing matched. It was just a dead end. I was born in Britain, so I could get a permit to work in Ireland. That was no problem. They said that my wife, who is Canadian, that she could just come over there and she would get granted residency once she arrived. And then for 5 years, she couldn't work until she sort of had the, whatever they call it over there. I don't know if it's called permanent residency, but they have another term. So we were like, great. And, you know, it just seemed so good. Got over there. We had a bunch of issues with my wife trying to get residency, and then she finally got turned down. Just nothing. It's hard to describe, but nothing went right. It became this huge dark valley that we had felt so strongly that it was the dream that God, you know, had placed on our heart that he was leading us. It became this dark valley that we seemed like couldn't get out. I don't want to sound like a real wimp here, but there was months that I just sat so kind of down, you know, almost the verge of tears all the time thinking, I just can't believe this. We're going to have to go back to Canada. You know, this, my future is erased. I don't know what to do. And so anyhow, we ended up being there a year. Came back in 2007, really absolutely wondering how Lord is our shepherd and how Lord had been our host. Really, I was really deep down, really confused on that. But we needed to work, so I arrived back in Clone. I went to work for a friend of mine who has a renovation company. I mean, I can hit nails, but I'm not very crafty, if that's, you know, or skilled, that kind of thing. But I was the guy who drove around the dump truck. I got to go in and wreck things, you know, tear out all for the renovations and then drive it to the dump and dump it. So, I spent a lot of time at the dump with the 1-800-GOT-JUNK guys and the BFI guys. I became part of that tribe, you know, and the lady at the hut there, she knew me by names all the time. So that became my place. And I remember it was one Friday, and it was 2007 in September, and it was a Friday, and I had this load and thought, you know what, I think I just have enough time to get to the dump and dump this off, but the truck had one of these gas gauges that kind of goes like this, you know, you never really know what kind of, and I thought, it should be needing gas pretty soon. So I get into the lineup at the dump, and of course, everyone wants to get through there before 4:30, and they shut the doors. I get onto the scale, it dies. A lineup's behind me, like, just, ugh, and the lady's going, we got to leave here in 5 minutes, and you got to get off here. So, I mean, I don't have that long of hair, but I got out of the truck, and I pushed that dump truck off the scale. I mean, it was just, and I just, you know, it was flat, or maybe it was a little bit of hill, I don't know, but it just got her moving, and I got it off, steered it off to the side, and I got it to the side, and I got out on the side of that truck, and I sat on the sort of step of that truck, and I thought, and it just hit me, I thought, you know what, my life, I'm out of gas at the dump, and I felt like that was where my life had ended up. Inside, I felt like I'm out of gas at the dump. And I just sat there and thought, how did I end up here? Sitting out in the Glenmore Valley in the dump. And I sat there and I just looked out and I, you know, there's all those seagulls and ravens. And I thought about, you know, Elijah got to a place like that and the ravens fed him. And I thought, not that hungry, but anyway. I thought about Job and how he ended up, he lost everything, and it said his body was full of sores and just sat there on, it says, the dump heap and scraping himself. And all that was left was a wife that said, curse God and die. And I thought, oh, man, you know. But it was interesting, because you know what else I thought as I sit there? That Jesus died outside of the city on a dump. They figure that's kind of where he was crucified. And somehow I had a sense that God was there. Jesus was with me. I didn't like where I was. I didn't want it to be there at all. I couldn't figure out how everything had changed and turned that I was there. But somehow God was with me. And it didn't make it easy. It didn't make it, you know, simple. And it didn't really strike me till months later. I end up with this discussion with Willow Park and the Midnight Brethren about relaunching the Garden Valley Church. Now, we had a few gatherings, and because some of the, you know, that church shut down and there was disappointment and pain and all that, I said, let's have an evening where we come together and pray, you know, really try to clear the air and take communion together. And I thought I was doing it for them. You know, I really thought, you got to do this for people that are hurt by the, you know, or disappointed and really hurt by the church. They need to get over that and move forward. And as I sat there and we took communion at the end, it struck me. You know, whatever months that was before, 8 or 9 months before, I had sat at the dump in Glenmore wondering how I ended up there. And there I was, a mile and a half down the Glenmore Valley at God's table, exactly where I knew I should be. And I realized that the shepherd, the guide, had been with me through it all. Didn't make sense. So much of it didn't make any sense to me. And I'm going to say that I still haven't got it all figured out. But I sat there at the Lord's table again as, you know, as I'm trying to be the guy who hosts taking communion, having a sense that I was at the Lord's table. He was my host. Which is an amazing thing to think about, and because the second most intimate thing you can do in the Middle Eastern culture back when Jesus was alive was put your feet under somebody's table. That means you're really with them. And I had a sense that I was really with Jesus. And I don't understand today all the struggle and all the pain and some things we went through, how we had to go from Summerland through Ireland to get to the Glenmore Valley. I mean, that doesn't make any sense at all. I mean, that's an expensive route. I mean, a big detour. But it wasn't. I think going to Ireland and just one thing, going to Ireland and landing in a place that really is a mission field, and then landing back in Clona, a place that I was raised most of my life, and landing it and thinking totally different. This is a mission field. Totally changed how I think about pastoring. Totally has changed how I'm thinking about how we can launch this and really be a blessing in a community. But enough of me. I just want you to ponder for just a moment, and I'm going to ask the team to come up because they need a few moments to get up here to get organized, and I'm going to pray. But I just want to ask you to ponder a little bit. Don't steal their songs. Do you really see God as shepherd and as your host? We're on a journey, and it is really a beautiful journey. And God guides us through it, and at times when we are worn out and just have nothing left, he sits us down at his table and says, I will host you. I will take care of you. Do you see God that way? You know, as I read this, what David was going through and read this psalm that is so popular in the Christian world, I thought of all the other ways David could have described God. But he describes him with these two images. I think images that connect with us deeply. Truth about who God is. The God of the universe, the one and only true God, is a God who is our shepherd, he is our guide, and he is a God who is our host, who serves us. We serve him, but he also serves us. And this journey we're on has ups and downs and twists and turns. God is with us. Let me pray.